This is the takeaway for July 14th, 2015.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And on this Bastille Day, the 27th day of Ramadan in the Muslim calendar, the deal is done. More than a year of negotiations between delegates from Iran and six nations led by the United States have produced an agreement finally to limit Tehran's nuclear capability in exchange for the easing of Western economic and military sanctions, some that have been in place for decades. Here's President Obama speaking from the White House.
Today, because America negotiated from a position of strength and principle, we have stopped the spread of nuclear weapons in this region. Because of this deal, the international community will be able to verify that the Islamic Republic of Iran will not develop a nuclear weapon. This deal meets every single one of the bottom lines that we established when we achieved a framework earlier this spring. Every pathway to a nuclear weapon is cut off.
This deal is about more than just nuclear weapons and centrifuges and verification inspectors. In one bold act of diplomacy, it immediately reestablishes a relationship between Iran and the USA that has been broken since the Iranian Revolution back in 1979. Joining me now, Robin Wright, distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington and the U.S. Institute of Peace. She's a contributing writer for The New Yorker who has been following blow by blow these arduous final round-the-clock talks in Vienna for an article this week on how Iran was being pushed from inside and outside to get this deal done.
Well, this was around-the-clock diplomacy that was sustained by an array of kind of disgusting snacks, carbs, and sweets just to keep them going. This has gone on for 19 days and is the single longest diplomacy for Secretary Kerry, but also the longest U.S. mission in more than three decades. This is really something the administration was committed to. And after many false starts, several delays, they decided to stick with it. And a senior official told me in the wee hours of this morning that they got far more than what they needed to make a convincing case in Washington.
Talk about personal diplomacy here and the status of individual leaders, individual statesmen and statespeople. Is this an Obama deal? Is this a Rouhani deal? Is this a John Kerry deal? Or was this just inevitable? It was going to happen in this eight-year period. The question was when.
Well, it's a little bit of both, but I think your question is very apt. You have the intersection of forces, political forces in the two countries that for the first time they could get beyond 36 years of hostility. President Obama campaigned on getting out of Iraq and Afghanistan, but most of all, trying to do a deal to prevent a 10th country from getting a nuclear bomb, which might have started a volatile arms race in the Middle East. And he stuck with it doggedly. And Secretary Kerry really was also the right man for it because he has, in his own family, his daughter married a Persian, an Iranian, and he is not unfamiliar with the culture, the ways, the thinking, the tradition, the history of a proud country. And then you had in Iran the election 2 years ago of a centrist president replacing the hardline Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And he brought with him the most talented diplomat in Iran who was educated in the United States, spent most of his adult life in the United States and has two children who were born here and are American citizens. And so that combination of the four men was really important in understanding each other, not knowing how to read each other, and also having the same agenda. You know, it was time after 36 years to get beyond the tensions that had defined not just their relations, but pretty much the state of play across the region.
6 months and the sanctions will be lifted if all goes well, according to the Obama administration. Do you see diplomatic relations actually following after that? And if a deal can be worked out with Congress, what is likely to be the Obama legacy at the end of the term if we look at the U.S.-Iran relationship in, say, 2017?
Well, this is the most important foreign policy initiative the president has taken. And, you know, it is on a par, if not as big, as what Nixon did with China. But ironically, it took the United States longer to repair relations with Iran than it did for the Nixon administration to repair relations with China after its revolution, and much longer than it took for the United States to repair relations with Vietnam only 20 years after a war that killed 58,000 Americans. So this is important on a lot of different levels in changing the tune, the dynamics, the atmospherics, the capability. I suspect the language will continue to be bombastic out of Iran. The supreme leader continues to talk about the United States as its arrogance and call on Iranians to stand up to that arrogance. There will continue to be hardliners who are fearful that Iran's revolution is at stake. There are fears that just like when Gorbachev opened up to the outside world, it led to the unraveling of the Soviet Union, that this deal will also undermine the revolutionaries who, after all, now in advancing age, are concerned about what happens next.
Finally, in the short term, is this verifiable? Do people worry that these terms of verifiability might be difficult to actually execute? And long view, will Iran eventually be a nuclear power? What do the folks you speak with say?
I think for the next 10 years, it's going to be pretty hard for the Iranians to come up with a secret program. For those, you know, it's often said by people who don't know the complexities of building a nuclear program, how hard it is. The Iranians have done it. And in fact, they basically have the knowledge to build a bomb. It's always been creating incentives to make sure they don't. And part of that is bringing them into the international community. So it's verifiable, but it's even tougher than Ronald Reagan's trust and verify. It's distrust and verify. And remember, the military option is still on the table if they don't. It's not totally off forever. Iranians are looking for a bit of normalcy right now. And I think the vast majority of the population wants to get beyond its pariah status, wants to reengage with the international community, wants to be able to breathe deeply and not worry about when they might get struck or going to war again. They fought the grisliest modern Middle East conflict. And remember, the fact that the deal expires in different parts in 10, 15, 20, 25 years doesn't mean it can't be renegotiated. And it doesn't mean that a lot isn't going to change in the meantime.
Robin Wright, distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington and the U.S. Institute of Peace. She's a contributing writer for The New Yorker. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The historic New Horizons space probe made its appointment with Pluto today, way out on the edge of the solar system. Its signals coming back to Earth will take some time to get here. In the meantime, what might New Horizons be thinking about? Maybe it's singing to itself and thinking about what's happening back home. Drifting 9 1/2 years, I got a job to do out here. Lord, I'm 3 billion miles away from home. I miss the earth where I come from. Couldn't be any farther gone. Lord, I'm 3 billion miles away from home. Lord, I'm one. Lord, I'm two. Lord, I'm three. Lord, I'm three. Lord, I'm 3 billion miles away from home. If New Horizon does have a song to sing today, MIT Planetary Science Professor Richard Binzel will hear it at the Johns Hopkins Science Operations Center in Maryland. Binzel is the science team co-investigator for the New Horizons mission, who outranks New Horizon, in fact. Pluto has been Binzel's mission for 35 years.
It is impossibly far away, or it was impossibly far away until now. This is like climbing Mount Everest. It's a grand achievement to get a working spacecraft 3 billion miles away from Earth.
I'm amazed at the clarity of the pictures. I mean, what are we seeing when we're looking at the surface of the planet and of its moon, Charon?
We're seeing a world unlike any other that we've ever explored before, and that's why we go. We want to know, how does nature work at the far reaches of our solar system, where the temperatures are below 100 Kelvin, and it's just so incredibly cold that even things that we take for granted, like the nitrogen in the air in our room, is even frozen.
Now, does the surface suggest there's something dynamic going on? It seems to me in these kinds of temperatures, everything would be inert.
That's what's one of the amazing things about Pluto. It seems to have seasons, and that seems crazy for a small world so far from the sun. I want to see, where are the polar caps? What ices are located where? What does that tell us about? We have ideas and models for how the sun rises and sets and what the length of seasons are, 100-year-long winters on some regions of the planet. Some regions are made of methane ice. Some regions are made of nitrogen ice. We just have to sort that out. Those are some of the key things we think that are there on Pluto, and exactly which parts are which and how they're sorted out and how they got that way. Those are all the pieces, and it's certainly going to take time to arrange those pieces and make the puzzle clear as to how this all works.
Is this a solid world in the way we understand solid worlds here on Earth, in that it's made of metal, rock, minerals, that sort of thing? Or is it a solid ball of gases that would boil away if we ever came close to it with our room temperature devices?
Well, Pluto is a ball of ice, and maybe in the center it's rock, but it's definitely a solid object out at 3 billion miles from the sun. And to be sure, if we took Pluto from where it is, brought it into the Earth, where the Earth is, a lot of those ices would, in fact, melt, evaporate. But it's very comfortable and very normal for this icy world out where it is.
Is there a suggestion that worlds like this might be a source for interplanetary explorers to get a big chunk of oxygen to put on board?
We know that Pluto's moon Charon has a lot of water ice in it, and thirsty astronauts like water, and you can get oxygen out of water. That's one of the findings over the past decades or so, is how prevalent water is throughout the entire solar system, including at the far reaches of the solar system where the water has been frozen for 4.5 billion years.
Now, even though it's traveled 3 billion miles, New Horizons, I don't believe, is made to go much beyond Pluto. Can it explore beyond the solar system?
So thanks to Newton's laws of motion, the New Horizons spacecraft will continue on into space. It will leave the solar system. And we have found that there are other objects that it might be able to encounter. Pluto is part of this broad region of the solar system we call the Kuiper Belt, which contains millions and millions of smaller bodies. And there are two or three that we think we have enough onboard fuel to navigate to. But right now we're focused on the mission at Pluto. After Pluto, we'll finalize plans for what we might do. And ultimately, it will require NASA's approval that we continue.
How remarkable is this probe, and how confident are researchers and engineers that it's going to complete its mission?
This is the little spacecraft that could, and it's the little spacecraft that does. This is a fantastic team of scientists and engineers that has just worked together really like a family from day one. And we have incredible confidence that we have done everything humanly possible to deliver a healthy, robust, fully functional spacecraft to the most distant regions of the solar system. So we're going in with great confidence, great joy, with that little bit of remembrance that spaceflight is very hard, and we never forget that. But we think we've planned for just about everything, and it's those unknowns that still linger in the back of our mind. But we're exploring in the grandest way we know how.
This is a dwarf planet. It's been, sort of demoted from full planetary status, yet Pluto is a member in good standing of the Roman gods, so it certainly has the profile that it always had. How do you feel as an explorer being a part of this mission, observing closer than ever before something you've been studying for 35 years?
In a historical context, this is absolutely amazing. The broad context is that over the last 50 years, from the first Mariner spacecraft, now to New Horizons, we have at least had the first reconnaissance of all the major worlds in our solar system. And in one way, this is the end of an era. It's the end of the first exploration of our solar system. But that means it's a beginning of the next era. And it's just amazing to be a part of that. It's amazing to think that we are the generation that accomplished this first exploration, this first series of explorations in our solar system. And that just feels absolutely amazing.
Well, you're certainly in the 3 billion mile club, Professor, that's for sure.
That's fantastic. That's a fantastic way to put it.
Richard Binzel is MIT Planetary Science Professor and a science team co-investigator for the New Horizons mission, taking a look at Pluto. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
The announced deal today with Iran on its nuclear program is being greeted enthusiastically by people on the streets of Tehran, although the government is having no official celebrations today. It's also being welcomed by Iranians from all over the world who have yearned for decades that their country be viewed as normal by the international community. Trita Parsi is founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States. Trita, how are you feeling today?
I couldn't feel better. This is amazing. This is absolutely historic. I've been looking forward to this day for more than 15 years.
And why 15 years? What was the milestone there that made you believe this was possible?
Well, I always thought that it was possible, and I think it's very interesting that the president pursued this path despite the fact that conventional wisdom in Washington always read that the Iranians would never make a deal with the U.S., it would go against the pillars of their revolution, it would go against their ideology. I always argued against that because I thought if you take a closer look at Iranian foreign policy, the interest of the state has always trumped ideological imperatives.
Do you think the country of Iran can keep its revolutionary ideology and pursue the positives in this deal over the next 10 to 15 years?
I think the revolutionary ideology has already been weakened significantly. It's a very normal process. Revolutionary states don't tend to remain revolutionary particularly long. They may keep some of those ideals, but their behavior tends to become more and more normalized. And that's the same thing with Iran. And this deal actually will help that, because the more Iran is integrated into the world economy, the more the Iranian people will have an empowerment to be able to push the country in a positive direction when it comes to political freedoms, human rights, etc.
Trita, let's make some plans together now. What is the first thing you want to do in Iran, the first plan you want to make to visit someone, the first place you would love to go? What are you dreaming about doing if the implications of this deal actually open up Iran for travel and freedom for people like you?
Well, let me answer this a bit differently. I think Iran has the potential of becoming one of the hottest tourist markets in the next couple of days, particularly for Americans. It's a completely different civilization. You can go there for everything. You can go skiing in the mountains 2 hours north of Tehran, or you can go down to the beaches a couple of hours south. You can go there for religious purposes, because some of the most holy sites in Judaism and in Islam are found in Iran. So there's a tremendous variety, and I think after 35 years of being closed off, there's going to be a huge interest for people to rediscover Iran.
And what about you personally?
For me personally, the first thing would be to actually meet family members that I haven't seen for a very, very long time. My grandparents, cousins, uncles, aunts, the whole family.
Lots to think about. Do you think the human rights questions in Iran will take center stage now for people like you, or will they be shuttled off to the side as people are very excited about the potential here?
No, actually, I think it's been shuttled around to the side as a result of the nuclear issue taking so much space. I think now when the nuclear issue is out of the way, I think more focus will be able to be brought to both human rights and other types of rights in Iran that have been deprioritized or, you know, fallen under the shadow of other issues. And I think also for the Iranian government, for President Rouhani himself, now when the deal is done, he's going to have to meet the pressures from society for greater freedoms and things of that nature that the society patiently have agreed to not push for at this moment because they realize the necessity of getting a nuclear deal first. But I think July 14th is going to become a very important day. And I think it's not just for Iran. I think this is going to change so much between the United States and Iran. It has the potential of changing a lot of things in the region. And more than anything else, this was achieved through diplomacy. This is a major global conflict that was resolved without a single fire being shot.
Trita Parsi is founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States. Thanks so much, Trita.
Thank you so much for having me.
Four years after allowing gay and lesbian troops to serve openly in the U.S. military, the Pentagon signaled this week that it did not want to repeat the frustrations of the don't ask, don't tell years in its approach to transgender citizens who want to serve in the military. The decision comes with active support from some Democratic lawmakers and with almost no resistance from the public. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter announced the policy reversal in a statement this week. Staff Sergeant Patricia King has served in the U.S. Army for 16 years, and in June, she became the first infantryman to reveal openly that she is transgender. She joins me now. Welcome.
Hi there. How are you?
Let's talk about a couple of milestones for the military. Certainly, you know, in the public, there's the Caitlyn Jenner, you know, openness about being transgender. But I suspect the Bradley Manning, Chelsea Manning situation also was an earlier milestone for the military, examining some of the pressures that people are under when they serve. Can you explain how you might have analyzed that situation as it came down?
Well, we have to remember that with Chelsea Manning, it was a little bit different because she was incarcerated. So the rules were different for her because she fell under the federal prison system.
But she is someone who experienced an extreme amount of pain and pressure, and certainly her defense team was contending that her difficulties in trying to find her identity within the military contributed in some sense to her breaking the law. Now, that might not be the case, but I suspect that a lot of people can identify with that sense of pressure.
Certainly, I think a transgender person who is in the military up until this point has had pressure on them, and we will continue to have pressure, but that's true of any soldier. We have an incredibly important job to do. For me, speaking personally, I know that I've always had pressure to do my best in my job, and I've applied that to making sure that I take care of my soldiers and putting my mission first.
How is Ashton Carter going to proceed with this policy reversal? There's a working group that's going to be established. What will happen there?
Well, I would suspect that over the next 6 months or maybe a little less, what we're going to have is we have four branches of service that have different regulations that cover things that now we have to make sure that they all come into alignment to protect transgender people and also make sure that we're accomplishing the mission. Things like birthing and stuff like that. So I believe the DOD will probably look at how they can make all of those policies fit into all of the branches of service without having any issues in mission readiness.
How would you say in 16 years that the military culture has changed to permit a decision like this to happen with almost no friction, no sense of rancor? I mean, I suppose we have to wait and see, but still, there's certainly a sense that this is relatively painless.
It has been incredibly warm. I can speak from my own personal experience. In my unit, when I came out and I shared with people in my unit, what I got was, we care about how you do your job, and you do your job incredibly well. You're a professional soldier, and who you are doesn't affect that. And they just wanted to be warm and supportive. And I imagine that we're probably seeing that in a lot of places.
What about your commanding officer?
My commanding officer, both at the company and battalion level, have been so supportive. We've had sit-downs. They've asked me to explain things so that they could become better educated. And they've just wanted to be able to support me. And now I think that it's so exciting for them as well as me because we're going to have policies in effect that allow them to do that.
Did you, and if you'll forgive me if this is too personal, did you transition while you were in the military or before?
I started my transition while I've been in the military. For me, I wanted to be able to be open and honest about who I was. So when I made this decision at every level, I went to my supervisors and I let them know, this is what I intend on doing. And I know that the most important thing to you is going to be that I'm able to do my job, and it will never get in the way of that. And what I got told is, as long as you're able to do your job, we're going to continue to support you.
Does this decision facilitate your ability to contact others within the military who have similar issues and allow transgender citizens to become a group that is openly proud of its service?
I certainly hope so. I actually belong to a group right now called Sparta. And within Sparta, we have a group of actively serving transgender military folks. And what we're hoping is that we will now have the ability and capabilities to outreach to people who didn't know that they're not the only one, so that we can help them to find the services and the support that they need as well.
How much do you think, or how frequently do you think commanding officers have to deal with the issue of a transgender soldier in their midst?
Well, we suspect that the recent numbers say that there's probably about 15,000 serving transgender soldiers or service members right now. So I would say that any battalion commander stands to have 1 to 2 transgender people within their formations. And those numbers are all estimates at this point because, of course, people haven't been able to be honest about who they are.
You're certainly lucky in the experience that you've had, others not so lucky, and you're familiar with them. Who can you think of, without mentioning any names, will find this decision particularly warm and embracing for someone who's maybe had some real difficulties?
Absolutely. I've had friends who have not had the same positive experience I've had, both people who prior to these changes have been discharged for being transgender, and people who now serve while being transgender and their unit has not removed them, but things may have been a little bit more difficult for them. And I think their units are probably also looking for that same guidance. How do we take care of this soldier properly? Because in the end, every leader who cares about their soldiers wants to make sure they're taken care of.
Staff Sergeant Patricia King has served in the U.S. Army for 16 years. She, in June, became the first member of the infantry to reveal openly that she is transgender. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So if rules are discarded, do human beings revert to some brutal survival mode where cruelty becomes the norm? Well, philosophers have certainly had a lot to say about that down through the years. But back in 1971, Stanford University psychology professor Dr. Philip Zimbardo wanted to get some solid data. He conducted an experiment. In it, 24 male students were selected and assigned the role of either prisoner or guard. The guard designates were given uniforms and nightsticks. The prisoners were stripped of their identities and held in tiny cells.
What is happening to Prisoner 819?
Prisoner 819 is being punished, Mr. Correctional Officer.
Let's give her 5 months, make sure you remember it.
Prisoner 819 is being punished, Mr. Correctional Officer.
Down.
You can hear in that audio from the actual 1971 experiment the gusto in which students are dominating one another in the scenario, but that was just the beginning. Eventually, the experiment went completely haywire and had to be halted before the end. Decades later, a film has been made of this episode in the history of behavioral science, the Stanford Prison Experiment.
You're going to be pleased to know that you all have been chosen to be the prison guards. But under no circumstances whatsoever are you to physically assault the prisoners in any way. So remember, just as you were watching the prisoners, my graduate staff and I will be watching you.
That's actor Billy Crudup playing Dr. Zimbardo with an admonishment that went unheeded by the subjects in the end. The film tries to get inside the heads of the people who saw a side of themselves that day and those 6 days that they might have preferred to keep hidden. With us are Dr. Philip Zimbardo from the original experiment and the man who plays him in the film, Stanford Prison Experiment, Billy Crudup. Welcome.
Welcome. Good to be here.
Thank you very much.
So this was a very unique moment in the history of psychology. You must have been hoping for some kind of sparks to fly when you did this originally back in 1971.
No, not really. The reason I did this study, it was really a follow-up of the earlier research by Stanley Milgram at Yale, in which he had ordinary men, older men, not with college background, play the role of teacher, and their job was to train their student to improve their memory. But the way you help them was by hurting. So you gave electric shock every time they made a mistake. And what happened is over time, the majority, two out of every three American citizens, this is 1,000 people he tested, delivered extremely painful electric shock. So
Got into the zapping there.
Zapping.
Yeah, right.
And now, so my study was an extension of that because in real life, people rarely do authorities say you must hurt somebody. More often, we're in situations, we're in groups, we're in teams, we're in office setting, schools, summer camps, mental hospitals, where we play a role, we have a costume, and nobody tells us to do bad, but suddenly social norms evolve. This is how we treat mental patients. This is how we treat prisoners. This is how we treat students. And so I wanted to capture that dynamic of character transformation. Now, the other thing is, in most psychological research, it only goes 1 hour. I wanted to see people getting into their role, into their character. So our study went 24/7. Mm-hmm. Prisoners lived there night and day, and guards worked 8-hour shifts.
So in playing this role, Billy Crudup, Is it the evil Dr. Zimbardo or the benevolent Dr. Zimbardo who, you know, runs into human nature and it goes foul on him?
He's sitting right next to me. It's going to be...
You know, the fact of the matter is, for me, it was a question of curiosity. What I admired about the experiment and about the subsequent reaction to it is the curiosity about how people are made up. What makes up our sense of self, our strongest sense of self? And as an extension of that, we have these institutions that we sort of take for granted, that were handed down from high. The government, the prison system, the healthcare system, education. You know, there's all these institutions that, as I was growing up, I just assumed were granted to us on stone tablets sometime before. But, you know, as you become an adult, you understand that these are man-made structures with all of the flaws and cracks and unprepared things that make up human beings. And so the process of doing, of playing this part and being a part of this movie has been illuminating for me insofar as I've learned to take my understanding of institutions less for granted.
Could you feel the power of this kind of blowing away of civilization for a moment that felt like that's what you achieved in some of these moments, Doctor?
Well, there's no question. I think that was part of Dr. Zimbardo's journey on it as well, was the sense of discovery that he had created such a provocative environment that he had the potential to manipulate it as well, neither for good nor for bad, but that it could be manipulated quite easily with a little prodding here, a little prodding there. And the movie certainly tries to explore what that process was like for him. And yeah, he had a moment at the end of it when it took somebody very close to him to say, you're missing a couple crucial points in your through line here about what's happening.
Yeah, in fact, the movie not only reveals the gradual transformation of young men playing the role of guard into, for some of them, brutal, sadistic guards, and the transformation of some normal, healthy kids playing prisoners having emotional breakdowns. It also reveals the transformation in me, again, as played by Billy, where I became the prison superintendent.
And let's put that in context for a moment, yeah. Because 1971, we're much closer to the Holocaust. We're much closer to World War II, and the mythology of World War II, that it was all Hitler and the SS henchmen, and that the German people were kind of unwittingly sort of brought into this, was being questioned for the first time. And this was a moment of really seeing that in stark terms.
Absolutely. The 70s were a dramatic era. Also, in 1971... every one of those students had been involved in some anti-war activities, anti-Vietnam War. And in many cases, the universities called the police onto campus to break up student riots. So nobody liked police. Police were pigs. We used to put on the bumper, pigs are oink oink. In fact, Michael, one of the lead roles in our study, who plays the John Wayne character, says at the beginning, nobody wants to be a guard. And then he becomes the cruelest, most vicious guard. Mm.
So what do you think this says to audiences, Billy?
Well, yeah. I would
– scary stuff. I mean, is this a scary movie?
It's intimidating. I think what it says is don't take yourself for granted. Don't be so confident that you're a construction of some core sense of integrity and morals, that you're as much a part of the world that you occupy, your core beliefs, your motivations, as you are some sort of fundamental.
I mean, this close from the beast.
I think
actors have to learn that, right? Yeah. I mean, you're this close from the
We know it. Yeah.
Yeah. But again, on the one hand, you want audiences to say, what kind of guard would I have been? What kind of prisoner? If I was playing the role of Zimbardo, would I have ended the study early? But really, you want them to come away, as Billy says, with a sense of humility and compassion to say, I could go there.
The Stanford Prison Experiment, starring Billy Crudup and Dr. Philip Zimbardo, who played the psychology professor at Stanford, who led that experiment back in 1971. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us. We really enjoyed it.
And here's something to take with you today. Fans of Pokemon and Mario and gaming have turned the internet into a global farewell to the late Nintendo president Satoru Iwata, who died this month from bile duct cancer at age 55. The man who understood how to keep fun in games, who resurrected Nintendo from corporate irrelevance and created the immortal Wii, was mourned by thousands at the San Diego Comic-Con convention. There's a petition calling for Nintendo to create a digital avatar of Iwata, or even a sensor doll that can interact in Nintendo games. And in a viral video illustration come to life that shows Iwata lying down in a bed of flowers, eyes closed, surrounded by weeping Nintendo characters. Iwata's immortal words: "On my business card, I'm a corporate president. In my mind, I'm a game developer. But in my heart, I'm a gamer." That's all for today, but you can respond to anything you heard on today's program. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.